everybody, and welcome to episode 61 of the now once weekly Alexis Sale podcast. And hi, Talal.
Oh, hey, Alexi. How are you, Dad number two?
I'm fine, thank you. I'm okay.
I'm enjoying our weekly little catch-ups. It's quite nice.
Yeah, yeah. And I think the audience seem to quite like it as well. So the topics that we left on last week were aircraft and aircraft. Well, I mean, that's a widespread
airplane food. Am I right?
Not airplane food. Well, first of all, somebody mentioned planes that had crashed due to their window design. In the comments on YouTube?
Do you know what they're talking about?
Yes, of course I know what they're talking about. They're talking about the first commercial jet airline in the world, which again was the de Havilland Comet, which was a British aircraft. But you know, like all these things in the way they've been talking about, like the hovercraft, you know, British inventions that didn't quite make it. The problem, two problems, I think, with the Comet. One was that, as the comment says, it had square windows rather than round windows, and that meant that the people knew. I mean, engineers, I think, knew very little about what we now call metal fatigue. And so, because the plane had square windows, this placed a lot more stress on the skin, the aluminium skin of the plane, and caused tiny cracks to appear. And these cracks widened when the plane was pressurized. And so, several Comets essentially broke up in flight. And
it didn't just happen once and then they just pulled a halt to everything.
No, they didn't. No, not at all. They didn't know. They didn't know what they didn't know what had happened, partly. So you can suppose you cannot blame them. No, I think it happened at least. There were two fatal hull loss accidents with Comets in which everybody on the plane died before it was withdrawn from service. And I think they were then later put back into service, but by then, of course, it was too late, really. And also, the Boeing 707 by then had come onto the scene. So, I mean, the other problem with the Comet was that the engines were sort of in the wing route, as it were. The engines were inside the wing, four engines inside the wing, whereas the Boeing 707 had the modern design had the engines mounted on pylons beneath the wing. And so I think it made the Comet much more difficult to service. And also it made it more dangerous in that, you know, I mean, engines are highly explosive. And sometimes I go on about the incredible inefficiency of British arms industry and British arms procurement, because there was also a few years ago, they decided to build British AWACS, airworn radar system, and they chose it was called the Nimrod, but it was basically a Comet. And so they chose for this system a plane which by then in design came from the 1950s, so it's like now would be 70 years old. And I remember that there was problems with one of them blew up, I think, over Afghanistan, I'm not sure. Anyway, the whole project cost a vast amount of money.
So it's a radar system that goes on the plane.
It goes on the plane.
It's not to detect planes. Okay.
No, it was a radar system that went on the plane.
It was designed to go on the fucking Comet from the 50s.
They used a Comet, yeah. Yeah, I mean, probably some of the listeners can talk more about this.
What was wrong with these people?
I don't know. They wanted to use a British plane, but they could have used, I think, it was another commercial failure, but was the Vickers, I can't remember what it was called. It had four engines basically attached to the tail in pods. What the hell was it called?
That doesn't sound good.
No, that was all right. That worked. And that never had an accident, that plane. I mean, they didn't sell that many of them, but that had never, ever had an accident. Vickers, it was used by the RAF for a while as a kind of troop transport.
How do you spell Vickers?
V-I-C-K-E-R-S. Oh, that's one thing. Just to change direction,
Vickers Armstrong.
Yeah, what was the Jag? VC-10 it was called. The VC-10. Which had an exemplary safety record.
And they could use that. Tail, yeah, that's quite like...
You're like a business jet.
60s, 70s style.
Yeah, well, they're still all business jets, basically, have the engines mounted right at the back. And they could, I guess they could, but for some reason they chose to use some leftover Comets they had lying around, and it was catastrophic, and it cost billions. I mean, it wasted, and it was finally abandoned. I think they bought an American system, as they usually do. But interesting, I think I was going, every year I do this Radio 4 appeal, which is, it's broadcast on a Sunday morning, and it says, will you, it's for St. Martin's in the Field, and I'll be doing it this Sunday. And I go into a place in the city of London with other minor celebrities, and we answer the phones. So people ring in to donate. And it's mostly old people. But I've done it for about 4 or 5 years now.
Wow, that's so old school.
Yeah, well, it's typically it's the people who give to charity are people, the poor give to charity more than the rich. The rich know because they're greedy and they're addicted to money. But the poor give, but it's mostly old people because Radio 4, partly. It's mostly old people who ring in. So I answer the phone and I say, hi, it's Lexi. But one of the things that always surprises me is that particularly the women, the old women in their, how fluent they are in the United Nations phonetic code, the United Nations phonetic alphabet code, which I think we all know I am adept at Alpha, Bravo, Charlie, Delta, Echo, Foxtrot, etc. So when you ask these sort of ladies in their 80s for their postcode, they'll often go Delta, Charlie, 1, Whiskey Yankee 75. I don't know whether it's
something to do with they all used to be like phone operators or
they'd done service during. Well, they'd be. I mean, even in their 80s, would they couldn't have served in the war, could they? Maybe they. I don't know. They served in the force, but it's remarkable that most old. It's just these old women, and they go, okay, because you have to take their details there.
Yeah,
the bank details and that, and they often go like Charlie Delta. 7 and 9. I don't quite know why it is, but the old women giving to charity are surprisingly well versed in the United Nations phonetic alphabet code.
So I always get stuck on G.
Golf.
Golf. That's the most simple one.
Yeah.
So I'm normally like, Foxtrot, Indigo, Gary, and then you can.
That's a bit of a rundown of the Comet and its failings. And
just
then,
even as an amateur layperson, you just know that squares aren't an aerodynamic shape. But I guess this becomes common knowledge through incidents like this, through trial and error.
I think they thought it'd be just nicer to look out of. I think that was part of the reason.
Well, windows are square, aren't they?
Windows in the house. What can we see through the square window? We can see the plane breaking up.
What's that a reference to?
Play School.
Oh, great show.
Yeah, through the round window.
Why are you weren't even a kid when Play School was out. Why do you know that?
I know, I just... it was popular among students, I think. Uh-huh. Students used... We were talking about they used to bet on which window the story would be through. There was only, somebody was talking about that. I mean, you only had a choice of like 3 windows, but they would bet students every day. They would bet on which window. They would bet on which window the story was going to be through.
Speaking on faulty aircraft, someone on YouTube, Michael, commented that the problem with the airship. We were speaking about the airship last week. The big floating bum. Problem with the airship is that Europe has prevailing westerly winds. So, like, you can go to Turkey quite easily, but getting back, you have to, like, pedal back.
That's why they have engines, isn't it? But I don't know how hard they would have to fight the... They're going east. You would have to fight the westerly winds.
Especially if Storm Bert was around or something. It'd be
really tough. Yeah, but you'd
I
have guess. To have... I mean, that's where the engines come in, I suppose.
Yeah.
So
interesting. Yeah. So yeah, things seem so ideal and beautiful, and oh, it could be carbon free air travel, but then
yeah,
there's not nothing's perfect.
Yeah, I still maybe I don't know, as I say, I don't know what's happening with the Airlander. I hope things are going ahead for them, and we'll see them soon. I've seen the Goodyear blimp. Yeah, the American.
Did it say Ice Cube's a pimp on it?
Yeah. Well, there's also a line in Bill and Ted, isn't it? When Bill and Ted's Bill and Ted film,
Excellent Adventure,
Extraordinary Adventure, yeah, where they go back to the Wild West and they're in a fight in the, and Keanu looks up and he's having a fight with the guy. He says, "Look, the Goodyear blimp," and the guy looks up and he punches him. So me and Linda were driving through Los Angeles once, and I said, "Look, the Goodyear blimp." "No, really?" And there it was. I don't think,
but even that has to be tethered by a rope, doesn't it?
Well, when it's not going anywhere, yeah.
Oh, do they let it? Do they release it sometimes and let it?
Yeah, of course.
Fly around on its own.
Yeah, it flies around on its own. Yeah, I haven't seen it for a while. I used to see it over here when I used to do Wembley football matches, do aerial shots of that for a while.
Really?
But yeah, but as it reads, Ice-T's a pimp from Good Day.
Have you ever been in a blimp?
I've never been in a blimp, no.
Have you ever been in a hot air balloon?
No, I don't fancy that. That looks frightening. Don't buy me that.
Have you ever used a parachute?
No.
Done a bungee jump?
No, don't
fancy that. Have you ever been in a jet plane?
Yeah. I used to be frightened of flying, and then I had hypnosis and I became completely blasé about it. No.
Wow.
So since then, I've never been. You mean like a jet fighter?
Yeah.
No. No,
I'm surprised. Because in all your like documentaries you've made, you've never done one about like arms and military stuff and jet planes.
No, people have often proposed it, but then the...
Because that's how you get a free ride on one, and they do loop the loops and stuff.
Yeah. I remember a friend of mine, she won like a free flight in a tornado or something, but then she's very thin, so you have to be a certain weight for the ejector seat, and she was actually too light for it, so she never got to go in a tornado in the back seat.
You've driven a tank, we know that.
Yeah, I've driven a hovercraft as well around.
Oh, wow. Like a big one or a little one?
A little one. I did when I was with the Telegraph. I did a feature on there's a hovercraft factory down in Southampton in the place where they used to make Spitfires. It's super marine. I don't know what it's called now, but I went down there and interviewed them, and then they let me take out like a six-seater hovercraft. They let me drive it around Portsmouth Bay or whatever it's called.
Now they've got a funny, when you turn, it's not just It's you've got a bit of drift going on at the same time, don't you? So you've got to completely change the way you think about driving, right?
Yeah, it's not precise. It's not like a speedboat where you can make, it's more of a drift, you know, because essentially you're creating this gap of air between you and the water. So it's a bit, you're scooting along on that. So you can't make, my memory is you can't make very sharp turns.
Yeah, you're gliding everywhere.
Yeah. They said most of their contracts seem to be for the Colombian police at the time to interdicting drug traffic up the Amazon or whatever it was.
Going through like swampy forests and stuff.
Yeah.
You've got to be able to traverse water and land.
I hope they're still going. I don't know. But I think the article I wrote wasn't particularly, to anybody's. Didn't please anybody particularly.
What about a fanboat? Fanboat? No, you've driven
no,
a fanboat?
No, jet ski? Like in the Florida Keys. No, I think Linda's one. If Linda ever becomes world president, she's going to ban jet skis. She finds them particularly repellent. Jet skis and shipping mineral water over long distances. So she'd ban like Fiji water, which is stupid, really. Using up the Earth's resources to ship water around the country.
So this September, I went on holiday to to Cannes in the south of France, and just for a little beach holiday with my partner. And we were at the airport. We landed really late at night, and we ended up sharing a cab with someone from the airport in Nice to Cannes. And it was this super rich guy who insisted he pay for the cab and everything. We got really lucky that that we've met this guy. But it turns out he was on his way to the Yacht Festival in Cannes, the largest gathering of fucking twats who sell completely unnecessary pollution machines to other billionaire twats and stuff. And we were chatting to this guy in the cab, and we were obviously being polite to him. He was paying for our cab. And it was also an interesting opportunity to learn a bit, because he was very talkative.
Right.
And you don't even realize. So there's a couple things I wanted to let you know about. First off, just on this topic with jet skis, a lot of billionaires who own a big, massive super yacht, he said there's a big market in selling smaller yachts that follow the big yacht around. And the only thing that yacht is for is to carry the toys.
The toys, like the toys, jet skis.
And that's jet skis, little helicopters, like even a speedboat that pulls around like the rubber dinghy, the rubber rings and stuff like that. They just have a whole boat just to carry toys, he said.
It's
and
obscene,
to a billionaire, a toy is a fleet of jet skis, you know, for him and his mates.
Yeah.
But then he started telling me, he's like, got really hushed and started telling us about this whole other thing. Like super billionaires are prepared, like doomsday preppers.
Oh, right. Yeah. Yeah.
And you think a doomsday prepper, oh, some guy's built a bunker in their garden and has a bunch of tin cans in it or something. No, a billionaire will buy a multi-million pound yacht. And the sole purpose of it is for when the shit goes down, he can jump on his yacht. And he has a whole team, a staff, people on full-time wages that are just sitting on this yacht looking after it. And on the yacht is all the guns you could ever need, all the food you could need that will survive for ages. And then not only that, in South America, they buy these massive plots, like farms, that are currently functioning, just sitting there with cows and crops and everything. And they're just maintaining these farms just so when either the apocalypse or the revolution or the lower classes have had enough and decide to storm their mansions or whatever, just gets in his chopper, goes to his yacht, and just has a crew of people that take them to their farm, which is in some isolated place in the middle of the jungle in South America. And so they have these billionaires have these backup
plans. Yeah, it's just depressing, isn't it? My sort of...
So pirates are going to save, like, that'll be our last chance to catch them, would be
well,
pirates.
Well, that's my consolation is that I assume their servants will rise up and murder them.
Yeah.
I don't know whether they've thought of that, but, I mean, I take consolation in that.
And he said sometimes they have to think about that because the servants want room for their families on the yachts.
Right.
So they have to get even bigger yachts than they think. So these billionaires get caught off guard and they're like, oh, actually, no, I think I need one that's even bigger, because when the time comes, if they don't have that's their families with them, the servants will rise up, won't they? If they have to be treated well.
Yeah, that's a depressing... that's why we're destroying the planet, is for these people, really. It's why, you know, we have genocide. It's essentially for the benefit of these people, these multimillionaires. That's why there's a war in Ukraine, is to benefit the shareholders of BlackRock. Who are those people? That is why we have injustice everywhere, and why the gap between rich and poor is constantly getting bigger. It's for those people. It's not strictly relevant, but there's a writer. There was a writer called Tom Sharp who was very big in the South African writer. Who was very big in the 60s and 70s. Now sort of forgotten, but he wrote about South. There's one of his books, and. It's set in South Africa, and this white woman says to one of her servants, her black servant, she says, oh, you know, if the natives of South Africa rise up, you wouldn't kill me, would you? And he says, oh, no, madam. He says, I have arrangement with the house next door. The servants there will come and kill you, and I'll kill them. Which I thought was a brilliant kind of idea. a brilliant concept. And he said, oh, no, madam, you know, I like you too much. I couldn't kill you. But the servants from next door will come and kill you. And I'll kill the people next door.
So a billionaire would have their security team probably prepped and briefed on what to do in that situation. But then would the security team rebel?
Yeah.
And then who would he have to protect him from them?
Yeah.
I wonder how deep it goes, their preparations.
They must have thought, I mean, they're slimy, clever people in a sense. So they may have thought of this contingency
plans.
Yeah.
But all that means is they know they're evil.
Do they though? Do they, Talal? Do they know they're evil? They know people are out to get them, but they think people are out. I don't think they think that's because they're evil.
Okay, fair enough.
I mean, Hitler thought he was a nice bloke, didn't he? I mean, really. He would go, why's everybody why's everybody having a go at me? Hitler would think, I'm only trying to make things nice for German people. Everybody's shouting at me. Why are they shouting at me? Mm. Why are the Russians at my door?
I wonder. Mm-hmm. I wonder, surely there was a day Hitler looked at himself in the mirror and says,
well, it is, I mean,
I'm too deep in to go backtrack now.
Suppose, I mean, it is, you know, I hate, giving props, as it were, to other comedians, but the greatest comedy sketch of all time in many ways is we do shittily share an agent, the Mitchell and Webb.
Are we the bad guys?
Are we the bad guys? I mean, it is. I mean, it sums up everything about the human condition in that one sketch, really. I mean, it is absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, it is a good one.
And I don't know whether it's like Jesse Armstrong wrote it or David and Robert
rewatch.
Wrote it, but it is just the. I mean, it is the cleverest comedy sketch. You know, it's so brilliant.
Jesse Armstrong. Yeah, speaking of billionaires. Who went on to do Succession.
He did, yeah, and which is a very good show.
And me and my girlfriend have just started watching Mad Men for the first time.
Oh, really?
Which I think is a bit of a precursor for Succession and is, in terms of the heroes being absolute assholes, but for some reason you're compelled to like them, you know, and you're compelled to care about them.
You identify with them, yeah. I think Mad Men is like, I mean, it slightly goes off towards it. I mean, it's got one of the greatest endings of all time, I think, Mad Men.
No spoilers, please.
But yes, it's an amazing show, Mad Men, I think. I remember feeling ashamed, really, because I was sort of, you know, the attitudes that those people had, I don't know if, I lived through an age when, you know, when those attitudes were still, I mean, attitudes are bad enough now, but... Mm. You know, the attitudes, the sexism and the racism that's displayed in Mad Men existed at the time. And it really shone a light on that. I thought it was absolutely, I mean, it is one of the top 10 greatest films. And also, of course, I think I've probably quoted it before, that William Goldman line about, you know, for a movie, and the same is true of a TV series, to succeed, the seven people at least have to be at the top of their game, you know, writer, director, producer, and in this case, casting. I mean, finding John Hamm, I think, to play the central character, he is the perfect. Because he's so handsome, and I'm starting to forget the other
director, writer, producer, lead actors,
casting, the actors,
costume,
makeup, set one design, general set design, and these days,
although sound
CGI
is quite important,
well.
I might swap out sound, costume for sound.
Yeah.
Or make up for sound.
But it doesn't have to be seven. I mean, but it just has to be a lot of people, you know. It has to be everybody. Yeah.
And like you said last time you brought this
incidental up. Incidental music.
Yeah. These days, there's probably more than seven because there's CGI and post-production, yeah. other post-production yeah. things that have advanced so much.
Yeah, yeah.
I did watch Kneecap in the last week.
Oh, right. Okay.
And yeah, I was blown away by it. Just the subject matter is something that obviously has not been really been tackled in cinema, that being, you know, the story of Irish language and the struggle they had in Northern Ireland to not even just to have it legal, have it being taught in schools and having people be able to hold on to their traditional, their indigenous language, which is obviously very reflective and analogous, is that a word, of what's happening in like Israel and other countries.
Yeah, there is a parallel, yeah.
And it was really fucking rude and lots of drugs, and it really reflected party culture quite honestly, I think. And I was so shocked to see that all three of the leads were actually the three guys from Kneecap, because they all performed so well.
Amazingly, for their first acting job, remarkably confident performances, yeah. I think.
And having Fassbender in there as kind of a throwback to his role in Hunger.
Was it?
Was really interesting. There was even a reference to it, because he played the guy who did like the dirty protests and stuff in the prisons. Right. And,
what's happened to him, I think? Did he get caught up in some
Fassbender?
Scandal? Yeah. You see him around so much these days.
Well, he was in Kneecap.
He was in Kneecap, yeah. He is Irish, isn't he? I think.
Is he?
Surprisingly. You're looking it up.
I am trying to. Oh, he's German-Irish.
German-Irish, yeah.
Anything in the news about him? No, I saw The Killer. He did The Killer recently as well.
Oh, of course he did. You're right. Yeah, no, he's
all over.
That was
pretty good. Quite a simple, stripped-down film. You didn't like it?
Not really.
Okay. Do you think it was a bit too pretentious or something? What didn't you like?
Well, I'm a bit sort of that whole Hitman for Hire sort of storyline is always vaguely annoys me, really. Mm. It's sort of lazy writing in a sense. You know, so many others, an episode of the new series of Sandwich Bar, which is sort of about that partly.
Kind of like celebrating murderers kind of thing.
Well, yes, exactly. I mean, it's one of the... I wonder sometimes whether those films exist to habituate us to mass murder. Somehow justify it, you know. Although it does work... Oh, I'm doing... and we should get him on the podcast, actually. I am doing... Well, this is... I mean, we're recording this on a Tuesday, aren't we? Goes out on the Saturday, so that I am doing a Stop the War benefit this Thursday, so it will...
2 days ago.
2 days ago.
If you're listening to this on Saturday.
Yeah. But one of the people who will be appearing there is Khaled Abdallah. Khaled Abdallah is, I think, Egyptian. I met him over the years at a lot of... Palestine benefits. He played Dodi Fayed in Succession, and he also plays this character.
No, in The Crown. In The Crown.
In The Crown. Shit. Sorry, change that. Yeah, he plays Dodi Fayed. No, I'm not editing that out. The Crown.
You're a flawed human being.
Are you going to make me look? People think I'm perfect, and now they will see that.
No, they don't. Have you not read the comments? Everything we say on the podcast, Alexi's not got an encyclopedia in front of him. So, like, in the comments, you don't need to be angry when you're correcting us. Just politely inform us of a mistake. It's fine.
Yeah.
But, yeah, he was in The Crown.
The Crown. He plays a character called UGC in this new series of The Jackal, which is on...
Oh, yeah, on Sky.
Sky.
And, made by Steve McQueen, who went to my school.
Steve McQueen did make Jackal. No, he didn't. He's got nothing to do with the Jackal. So you're Day of the wrong Jackal? Now. You're going to leave this in where you're wrong?
Day of the Jackal?
It's called The Jackal, this one. It's got nothing to do with Steve McQueen.
Oh, the new series, The Day of the Jackal, is by Steve McQueen.
It's not.
Then why did I see him being interviewed about it?
He's interviewed about his new film, Blitz.
Well, there you go. We can all make mistakes, folks.
You're going to leave this in?
Of course I'm going to listen. Of course I'm going to edit it out.
Well, anyway, Khaled Abdallah is doing this, and we should maybe get him on. He plays a character called UGC, a kind of not Elon Musk, really, because he's anti-establishment. He plays the kind of the character anyway. Who's the jackal is after in the new series, which I do find really exciting to watch. Everybody's fantastic in it. I mean, Eddie Redmayne is.
You recommend it then? I've been kind of avoiding it.
No, I think it's terrific. I mean, I love the original movie. And obviously Eddie Redmayne is one of those upper-class actors who, I am by definition kind of against. But nevertheless, he is terrific and perfectly cast in this. Also, Lashana Lynch as his kind of he paints MI6 in it. Far too rosy light, obviously. Although, actually, she's very flawed. I mean, she's Lashana Lynch as his Bianca, his nemesis in MI6 is also. It's a terrific performance. It's written by is Ronan Bennett, who himself was an Irish Republican. It's all connected, you see.
Wow.
And actually did time in prison, I think, falsely, and was falsely imprisoned for the murder of a British soldier, I think, and then was finally released.
Is this based on the book that Carlos the Jackal got his name from?
Yeah, I think they may have... The original book is written by Frederick Forsyth, which it's a terrific book in itself, but it is, and then it was made into a movie by Fred Zimmerman. See, I'm doing all this without any notes in front of me.
I'm fact-checking you as you're going.
it's about an attempt on the life, which is sort of loosely based on reality. It's about an attempt on the life of General Charles de Gaulle by people who, the OAS, who were, I think were, because Algeria was a colonial possession of France, and there was a lot of French people who wanted that to remain the case. And in the end, after an extraordinary brutal civil war, and a film I would recommend is The Battle for Algiers, which is used as something as a handbook by anti-colonial forces. These Algerian white colonialists hire this British hitman to assassinate Charles de Gaulle, and it's about his attempt. By a policeman is hunting him down, and it's a terrific 60s movie. It's shot in a kind of, I think, Technicolor or Eastman, they're kind of really rich colors, and it's one of the Foxes, Edward Fox, I'm not sure which one. But he is fantastic as the Jackal. Now, I don't know whether the Jackal got his nickname from Carlos the Jackal got his name from the film, or whether the film...
It was Edward Fox, 1973. Yeah. I think Carlos the Jackal did get his name from the book.
From the movie.
Speaking of it all being connected, I know that because in the Iranian embassy siege, where my dad was a hostage, the housekeeper, Ron Morris, had that book, and he would sit and read it.
Right.
While he was a hostage, he'd get that book out and read it. And Carlos the Jackal actually, his actions actually inspired the terrorists that took over the Iranian embassy, partly inspired them. It's all connected.
It's all connected.
And my dad had a fist fight with Carlos the Jackal.
And yes, maybe we should do a deeper dive into the history of Carlos the Jackal at some point. There's also a terrible, terrible Bruce Willis remake.
Wasn't that just called Jackals?
Was it called Jackal? It's awful. I mean, it's utterly pointless remake. But as so many remakes are, really. The Bruce Willis one. I watched some film. I watched some film the other night or a few weeks ago on one of the platforms, and it was a Bruce Willis film, a cop thing. And I think they've kind of discovered halfway through that Bruce Willis has got dementia. So he actually doesn't. It's really kind of sad and odd film, because all that Bruce Willis says throughout the film is like yes or no.
Yeah.
And they go, boss, he's playing like a police commissioner or something. They get out of the car quite slowly. And then they say, boss, the gang is running down East Street. Should we go and, you know, stop them at the 7th Street Bridge? And Bruce Willis will go, yes. Or no.
Rather than give the
command. I wonder whether he got, like, got on set, you know, whether they found out, whether the producers went, look, I think
well,
we've got
no,
a problem
the
with
truth
Bruce.
Is, in the last kind of few years before it got really bad, he was aware that he had early onset dementia was kicking right. in, and it was going to get worse. So he just started accepting jobs.
Right.
And that's why in his last few years before his retirement, he did like 50 films, and they're right. all very bad. And his parts are quite minimal. They just wanted him in there so that they could put his name on the above right. the title, his face
so
on the poster.
So the producers
poster.
Knew that he was...
Whether it was an understanding between him and the producers, or whether right. it was just him saying, yeah, I'll do the job, but I have a maximum word limit and I'll only yeah. be in this many scenes. But people yeah. would give him the job anyway, just so they could have Bruce Willis in it.
It's just
so they were practically student movies that yeah. Spent all yeah. their budget on Bruce Willis.
Yeah. Well, this is a strange,
and he
sad
was doing that
film.
To save money for his retirement yeah, for his sure. kids and that.
Yeah. No, I mean, obviously, you've seen it. He's a, you know, at his best, he was a fantastic actor. And it's just a strange, sad movie to see this clearly, you know, confused man in the middle of these scenes. I can't remember what it's called now. It's some kind of cop thing anyway.
Yeah.
And it's quite a compelling watch, but not obviously not for really for reasons that are inherent in the movie itself. So it's an odd one.
We're roughly halfway through, so I just want to take this opportunity to remind our listeners that you can support the show. Please support the Lexel Podcast's future and growth by buying us a coffee every month, you know, and you can do that by going to patreon.com/AlexiCell Podcast. I won't use that money literally to buy coffee. Patreon.com/AlexiCell Podcast. You know, give us a hand. And if we get up to five, I found out the name of it is called a stretch goal. We have a stretch goal. If we get up to 500 patrons, we will do a live streamed episode where we'll allow you listeners to join the stream and ask us a question.
Yeah.
I think that could be quite fun. So come support the show, patreon.com/AlexiCell Podcast. Chuck us a couple of quid a month, 5 quid a month, yeah. whatever you can. It would mean a great deal.
So we're halfway through the show, so let's play Africa by Toto. Right away down in Africa. Okay, we're back. talking of things that were poignant, actually, I was saying Linda would ban jet skis.
Yeah.
And there was a few weeks ago on BBC Two, there was a night of music from Kirsty MacColl. And again, that was poignant, you know, nothing to do with music, but I mean, but because she was on a holiday, wasn't she, in Mexico, and was either decapitated or was killed by some oligarch on a jet ski, a Mexican oligarch. And what he did was he got his chauffeur to kind of admit to it in the end. And it was either the oligarch or the oligarch. So the chauffeur or some servant went to prison for killing Kirsty MacColl. But it was, you know, I mean, obviously one gets used to seeing dead people. But it seemed particularly, I mean, I don't know if I'd ever, I must have met her somewhere or other.
How did she host the show then?
No, she didn't host the show. It was Kirsty MacColl at the BBC or whatever. So it was... It was a Kirsty MacColl night on BBC Four, I'm guessing.
Oh, she
so it was,
was
just, you know, it's just her singing, you know, on top of the pops.
She was a singer.
Okay. On Jules Holland, on, you know, videos and interviews and...
Wait, and so how did she end up in that situation?
I think she was just on holiday when she was swimming off a beach in Mexico, and this twat on a jet ski, probably from his yacht, was hurtling around and just ran her over.
Oh. Wow.
It was awful. But also, since we seem to, well, I seem to be thinking about poignancy, there's a very, there's a documentary in... about Fairy Tale of New York, and that was produced by Steve Lillywhite, who was Kirsty MacColl's husband at the time. Uh-huh. And when he talks about making, and she did her vocals separate to Jane McGowan's, she just recorded them, I think, in their home studio. And so he's got the tapes there, and he's just playing, and he's just fading up. So he hears his dead wife's voice on the tape and seems to show no emotion. And you can hear his dead wife singing, unaccompanied, really, because, you know, it's a hair vocal track.
Uh-huh.
And that's a rather odd moment as well, I think, if we're looking for odd moments.
What, does he know he's being filmed?
Yeah, yeah, he's in the documentary and he's talking about
People react, people grieve in their own way.
Yeah, no, I'm not criticising him for it. I'm not saying he's heartless. It's just an odd kind of byproduct of, you know, the voyeuristic... aspect, you know, the voyeuristic aspect of what is being a TV viewer, really, is that you see a man, you're interested. So there's this documentary about the making of Fairy Tale in New York, how it was written. And then you see the man who produced it in his home studio with big, you know, 12-inch, you know, with those big thick tapes that people used to use. And he says, oh, and this is Kirsty's vocal, and, you know, flips up a slider and her voice pure and the voice of his dead wife comes up pure and unaccompanied on out of the speakers of this mixing desk, you know. Mm. It's just, it's not, I'm not criticising him for showing no emotion. It was just, it's just a sort of odd,
yeah,
you know, it's an odd, unintended consequence of watching this documentary that you suddenly see a man playing the voice, the unaccompanied voice, singing voice of a very sweet voice of his deceased wife. That's a theme that seems to have developed in this, that I seem to have teased out of this particular part of the show.
There's lots of talk at the moment about, on the social medias at least, about how, do they know it's Christmas, should fuck off and it's an evil song.
Yeah, well, again, I've got a bit in. I mean, I've always been a anti-celebrity charity, and there is a, I mean, I think times are catching up with me. I hope I'm still slightly ahead of the times, but there is a thread in the new series of Sandwich Bar, which is about celebrity charity events, you know, children in need.
Nice.
Specifically Comic Relief.
Well, this song, they're releasing this year, I think, a super cut of this song, which includes vocals from the original and from, like, I don't know, they did two more versions in 2004 and then another year with more contemporary singers. And there are people, and it's African voices, actually.
Are they finally allowed
to? They were saying, like,
oh, no.
Can this song fuck off?
For a minute, you're saying they'd allowed Africans to actually sing on the
free range. No, African voices have been speaking out on social media saying, when this song came out, tourism to Ghana dropped because everyone just thought it was a wasteland.
Oh, really?
You know, this song promoted the image of Africa being a deprived wasteland where there's no food and everyone's diseased. And it's like, we actually had a tourism industry, and you've lost us billions and billions of pounds. Like, the year before this song came out, we made however many millions in tourism. And then the year after the song came out, that we made like £2.50 out of tourism. And it's like, there was another argument as well. But yeah, the song has cost Africa billions of pounds. It's not, it's been counter. Helpful. That's not a good word.
Well, I also think, you know, I mean, I sometimes talk about this The philosopher Immanuel Kant, who said that, you know, the only moral act is one done out of duty. And in terms of charity, what it means, if you profit from it's immoral if you profit from, for instance, an act of charity. And this whole notion of celebrity charity events and charity in general, I think, is much more morally ambiguous than you would at first think, you know. And it does, yes, the damage that Live Aid has done, I think. I never knew about that tourism thing, but many people say that Live Aid prolonged the brutal Ethiopian civil war by as much as 5 years.
Oh, fuck.
It is at best charity, celebrity, not ordinary people. And I do stuff for charities. I do stuff for, you know, Freedom from Torture. I do stuff for medical aid for Palestinians. I do homeless charities. You know, that is, I think, do this St. Martin's in the Field thing that I'm doing on Sunday. And I think, but I don't think I in a profit from it. I hope I don't. And I think they are things that, by and large, just do good. But I think there is an awful lot that is wrong with those big, big celebrity things. And Live Aid was the start of it, and Comic Relief and Children in Need. I think they're morally dubious, and they're actually the good that they do, I think, is can you know if it's viewed through a broader lens, is it any good at all? Is it, in fact, is their ultimate effect?
But the world got an amazing Freddie Mercury performance out of it.
That's
live forever in history.
Yeah.
And as someone who's been with you during some of your charity gigs, I can assure the listener that you don't enjoy it. He's not doing it for pleasure or his ego.
No,
he's doing it. He's like fucking miserable.
Duty, yeah.
It is like self-flagellation watching Alexi have to fucking perform
backstage. I mean, I'm all smiles.
Right? Oh yes,
yeah.
And you get very angry and passionate. It's nice to see.
Yeah.
No Wilf today with you.
And now he's, I don't know where he is.
Being quiet. Well, send him our regards.
Yeah.
When we do the live stream, can we see Wilf? Asks Ruth. Yes. When we do the live stream, we'll get Wilf involved. He was involved in your Christmas message as well. Have you been thinking about what you're going to do this year?
Oh, fuck. I mean, Christ, what are you going to say? I mean, it's hard to know. I mean, obviously, It organically came out of my anger with Stephen Fry's shitey bloody message.
Yeah.
And so I feel like we should do one, but I mean, let's see what the official one is, really. It won't necessarily, I mean, it's also he knew that this shit would be going on 14 months long. Later. Yeah.
Well, we're going to have to get angry again, we'll think of something. I'm looking through some of our comments.
Well, we've done pretty well.
Yeah, we've done very well.
When are we supposed to be talking about With Nail? Next week, is it?
Yes, I've been holding on to that because, yes, we're going to do With Nail and I. We're going to talk about With Nail and I next week in the Alexis Sale Film Club, first podcast of every month. We'll have a new film. I'm wondering if the original Day of the Jackal might be our next film. But
these are films that I can do from memory, really.
I think it should be films that you know extremely intimately and very well.
Yeah.
I was toying with the idea like to suggest that maybe we should take turns picking a film. But no, it's the Alexis Sale Film Club, and I want to learn from it. And I think it helps the audience, the listeners' enjoyment of it, if I am like them,
right?
Kind of, watching something maybe I'm not so familiar with, and it's something you're very passionate about, and so we get to hear your opinions on it, and I will speak as a new watcher because I've not seen With Nail actually, and I've never seen Day of the Jackal. I'm sure there's a lot of stuff but also on the other hand, a lot of people suggesting stuff in the comments as well. So I'll always bring them up. And if they are something you're keen to do,
yeah,
But yeah, with Neil and I, watch it for next week. Someone said on the comments that it's available on Channel 4 on demand.
Oh, cool. So that's, okay, I was wondering where to watch it. Yeah.
That's free with adverts. You can also watch it probably illegally. So we do not advise it, but on a website called Daily Motion, you can watch it for free there as well. I'm not sure the quality will be very good either. Probably the best quality you'll get will be on Channel 4. Did you see that documentary about the loaded magazine culture of the 1990s? That was on BBC Two the
other night. You're asking me? Yes, I did. Yes. I know James Brown a little from, because he's at Larne every year. The Larne, you know, Larne is in.
Oh, not the singer.
Okay. No, not the Larne in North Wales, which is, of course, where Dylan Thomas spent a lot of time. And what? Oh, it's in South Wales, sorry.
A correction from Linda. She's been listening this whole time. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Linda. Hello. Hello. So it's South Wales, yes. It's in South Wales. And, of course, it's where Dylan Thomas wrote Under Milk Wood, and it serves as the...
So I didn't see this show, but it was a comment from the YouTube...
I sort of thought, because I also watched, I think there's one more episode to go. I watched similar in some ways. There's a series on, again, I think on BBC Two called Boy Bands Forever, which is 4 1-hours. The first one's about Take That, the second one's about the next generation of boy bands, and the third. Partly wanted to see episode 3 because Blue were in it, and of course I did Richard Osborne's House of Games with Anthony Costa from Blue, yeah. And so I just wanted to see my new friend Anthony Costa, and because I was obviously lost interest in. I was interested in Take That, and I remember bumping into Robbie a couple of times. I thought he was one of the other ones, but I was, you know, obviously after Take That era, I really, you know, was not interested in.
Are you up to date with contemporary music? Is there anything that you like that's kind of in the chart?
Well, just let me finish with this.
Please finish, yes.
Stream. But also it was interesting because the sort of, in a sense, the parabola of all the boy bands and the parabola of Loaded magazine seemed in a way to mirror each other in that it starts out as fun, then everybody has a breakdown and has to go to a mental hospital, which is the sort of story of, or into rehab, really, which is the story very much of Loaded magazine, but also of a lot of the boy bands that one of them will have a breakdown. I think Robbie has either done a lot of, he's been to a lot of AA meetings done a lot of therapy, I think probably both. Mm. And generally, there's one member of the band who's, I mean, poor Brian Harvey. I mean, Brian Harvey, in terms of E17.
Yeah. And that One Direction.
Liam Payne, yeah, Liam Payne. We haven't got to One Direction yet, but Liam Payne, you know, there's a terrible casualty. You know, it starts out and everything's great, and then there's at least one terrible casualty along the way. And Loaded was kind of like, I mean, there was a lot, well, we could probably talk, perhaps we could talk in greater depth about, maybe don't have the time. But
maybe that's also just reflective of men's mental health in general. I think 1 in 4 men or something is is very depressed and doesn't know how to get the psychological help they need.
Yeah, well, being in a boy band won't help with that. But the Loaded thing was also, I say, when James Brown's at Larne every year. And I watched him. He did.
Who's James Brown, for people who don't know?
He's the founder of Loaded magazine. Thank working you. Class, Leeds. Very, I mean, still, I think still, I mean, you know, it was seminal, that magazine. Obviously, again, it was not something that appealed to me or was part of my experience, but it was a magazine that kind of either changed the face of Britain or mirrored changes that were going on in Britain. And I think he's still wrestling with the legacy, in a sense, of it. But, you know, and it all it's all crazy antics, and then it gets a lot darker, really. And he talks, you know, about his mother died of a drugs overdose, so on and so forth.
Right.
He's an addict himself.
Were you ever on the cover of that?
Loaded. No, we were talking about this. I was on the front cover of, I think it was FHM.
For Him magazine.
Which became a kind of rival of
Loaded.
Of Loaded and just featured on its cover with girls from Hollyoaks with no, in their underwear. But before that, it started out as a kind of a, it was as a kind of rival to GQ. So it was a men's kind of fashion magazine. And I was on the front cover of that when it was called For Him magazine. And the,
in your knackers as well?
Our local news agent told me that, you know, like the copies that they didn't sell, they would return them and get a refund. And that was the most returns he'd ever had to send back, was the copy with me on the front cover of For Him a magazine had sold.
I think the bikini was a bad choice, probably.
Yeah. Now, this was when it was still obviously a kind of rival to GQ, and that copy of For Him magazine with me on the cover had sold. The worst selling magazine that he'd ever had in his shop.
Oh, fuck's sake.
He told me that. Thanks for that. I have been on the front cover of For Him magazine. But then, that may have been at the point where they thought, fuck it, we'll change the name to FHM and just have Hot naked girl. Young actresses on our cover.
That was
an interesting documentary. I think the Loaded magazines, it leaves a lot of questions unanswered. And it also features David Baddiel, somebody who, a regular character on this podcast, really, who really doesn't dig very deep into his own complicity.
Because he was part of that whole culture, wasn't
yeah.
he?
Yeah. And again, I don't think he reflects very honestly on.
Interesting.
His part in it, really. Maybe he did in the bits they didn't use in the interview. I don't know, but certainly the bits that they show of him, it's not a great deal of honesty there.
Apparently Baddiel was part of the voice that kind of misrepresented what happened in Amsterdam the other week.
Yes, he did, and he should, if, you know, if he's got any moral decency, he should, you know, issue a retraction, really, now that it's become clear what went on during those riots by the racist Maccabi Tel Aviv hooligan supporters. I guess he won't. People don't, do they, really?
Oh, are those Maccabi guys coming to London at any point, or coming to the UK for a match?
That would be interesting. Not that I know of, but
if they went and played against, like, is it Celtic or Rangers that are pro-Palestine?
Celtic.
That would be interesting, isn't it? Wouldn't it? Glasgow versus Maccabi. I asked you earlier, any contemporary music that you've been listening to?
I've used it to come on stage at the Museum of Comedy where I'm doing these triads. I use Nadine Shah's 20 Things. I think I subscribe to just like a music, you know, service, and it threw up. I just thought it was an amazing song, really.
Nadine Shah.
I've been listening to Nadine Shah recently, just to make myself seem like hip. She sings she's from the northeast somewhere. She sings in a sort of her own accent, really.
Oh, cool.
Can we play anything of 20 Things? Can we do that?
Well, yes, certainly.
We have to
certainly.
Pay somebody if we.
No, I'll put a little clip of it in. I'll play it at the end of the episode. Last week, I played that Isla White song at the end of the episode. I'll put a bit of Nadine Shah. I don't think I can put more than 30 seconds of it because she's signed to a record label. Very interesting. Yeah. I'll be interested to hear that.
Yeah. It's a story song as well. It's really interesting.
20 Things.
Sort of, yeah, it's a kind of, you know, it's not exactly a story. It's a, what would you say? It's a painting a picture song of a kind of world. Yeah.
What about Charlie XCX? Have you listened to her album?
I used to actually, funnily enough, she's been going quite a long time, as you can know. This whole brat thing was like last summer. Yeah. I used to come on stage to that one. You know, I drove my car into the bridge. I don't care. That's Charlie XCX, isn't it? And I remember hearing that in like 2017 or something, just thinking, wow, this is amazing. So I used to come on stage to that, actually.
Have you heard Brat?
No, I haven't really. No, I should have a listen, really, I guess.
Now, it's wild. It's wild. It's like not what you'd expect for like a number one pop album. It's really, I think, because the album before that and the album with I Don't Care on it was very poppy, and it was like she was very beholden to the record label and what they would label and what they wanted her to kind of make. Right. And then they finally, with Brat, they like, do what you want.
Right.
And she's made something really kind of really weird. It's fucking weird. And and hardcore in a way, like it's lots of drug talk and like real issues are being spoken about. And partying, Brat, the whole Brat, you know, the culture that she's kind of coined, this phrase is like not giving a shit, you know, going out partying really fucking hard all weekend, and then and I got into it through my girlfriend, and I really actually grew to really like the album, because it's just not what I was expecting for a pop album. It's not clean, it's not sweet, it's not cute. It's quite heavy electronic stuff. And for her birthday, me and my partner are going to see her this Friday. This is why we're recording on a Tuesday.
God. Where are you going?
We're going to Birmingham Arena to see her the Brat tour.
Oh wow. Are you the won't you be a bit old for?
Yeah, I'll probably be the oldest guy there. No. She's universal. I'll probably be the straightest guy there.
Right.
I'll say that much. But no, she's quite got, because it's so weird, such a weird album, it's got a weirdly wide appeal. And obviously it's such a huge part of the zeitgeist this year.
Yeah. I just started reading about it in The Guardian, which immediately put me off.
Yeah, and it was annoying that she said, you know, Kamala is Brat.
Yeah.
Which pissed me off.
I've also been actually, because, yeah, it's all
and
women.
And also, Charlie's in so many adverts at the moment. So she's truly like this year, this has been the year where she's just trying to make as much money as possible. It's clearly the case.
But that was like 2017, or 16, wasn't it? Like, I crashed my car.
What, Brat? Oh, that song,
I don't care.
But
yeah.
Brat is from this year,
Yes, I know that. Yeah, I've also been listening a bit to Kate Nash. There's a really rather, it starts out all right, but then goes really, really terrible series on BBC called Night Sleeper, which is about a night train from Glasgow being hijacked by cyber terrorists or something. And it just goes so stupid, because I'd love a film set on a train. And we could talk about that. Actually, that's another film we could do, actually, which I'd love to talk about, which is Von Ryan's Express, which I saw with my dad in Southport many years ago. Yeah, Von Ryan's Express would be an amazing film to
talk about. Next month. You can think about that for now.
But I was going to just say that but for some reason the woman hero is the sort of head of cybersecurity at the British Rail, an odd role to be a heroine, and the kind of disgraced former policeman who's on the train who's helping, you know, trying to stop this hijacking. At one point, just for no reason at all, they exchange a couple of lines of a Kate Nash song. Oh. One where she says, I think you, something like, you seem really bitter. Is it because your friends are fitter? So it made me start listening to Kate Nash, who had an interesting career. It was also an actress in that series, Glow, about Lady Wrestlers.
I was talking about Kate Nash this week, but I can't remember why. Well, fascinating. But I think we're out of time.
Yeah.
Kate Nash has an OnlyFans page. OnlyFans page.
I was thinking of MySpace.
I think kind of semi as a protest, semi as a joke. She's been posting pictures of her bum on OnlyFans because I think it's because something to do with how musicians aren't making as much money as they should, you know,
especially with blind.
Yeah. And like the only way they can make money is to perpetually do live shows, which is very bad for mental health and and physical health to just be touring all the time.
I mean, it's outrageous how the music has, how the revenue from music has been diverted away from artists. I mean, it was never that good. But I mean, as somebody who had a hit in the 80s, I remember talking to Tracy Thorn from Everything But the Girl about it, just saying, wasn't it great? You know, music, money just seemed to fall out the skies when you had a hit in the 80s.
Yeah.
I mean, you're still getting robbed by everybody. But I mean, now it's just how music has been diverted away from the artists into the pockets of crypto billionaires, you know?
Yeah.
It's a scandal of.
I should also add that Kate Nash is making a statement about sex work and how it's taboo and sex workers are often seen as criminals and scum and this when it's such a largely consumed product and we should be treating sex workers with a bit more respect. And yeah, so she's making a point about that and agency, female agency stuff, taking ownership of your body and that. And homework, listeners, watch With Neil and I before the next episode.
Yeah.
Your time starts now. Have a good week, Alexi.
You have a good week too.
That was fun. God, we start these not having a clue what we're going to talk about.
No, it's true.
And the time passed pretty quickly there.
It did, yeah.
So well done us.
Well done, everybody. We should have our own show on LBC.
We fucking should. Listeners at home, let us know we're doing a good job. Give us a pat on the bum.
Yeah.
And support us, patreon.com/AlexisSalePodcast. Follow us on social medias at AlexisSalePod. I've started filming our episodes and I just posted a little video clip of last week's episode on our Instagram. So go and give that a like and encourage me to make more of those. Anything else? No, can't think of anything else. Much love, listeners. Thanks for the support.
Thank you. Bye bye. You've been listening to the Alexis L podcast. This show is produced and edited by Talal Karkouti. Music by Tarbush Records. Thanks to Audio Boom for hosting us. Please keep your emails coming in at alexislpodcast@gmail.com. Goodbye.